So I'm not going to insult intelligence by reading all these requirements to you, but there are innumerable requirements really for what is required in this process. But when you go through these, you keep seeing phrases like equitable and fair and all these other notions that it's supposed to be impartial, unbiased, free from conflict of interest. That is the overarching requirement each and every step along the way. But you know, some of these that have given us more headaches than others would be like the process must require the evaluation of all relevant evidence, inculpatory and exculpatory. Well, now we're explaining to people involved in the Title IX investigation process who, for the most part, are not lawyers. They're going to be our administrators. Sometimes you can bring in outside help, but we're having to explain, okay, what is relevance? Well, the regulations don't actually define it. So we just have to tell, you know, counsel that relevance is something that helps you reach a conclusion. It's a wide net and what inculpatory and exculpatory evidence is. And all categories of individuals involved in this process have to be trained specifically on their roles and how to go through the process and navigate it. Supportive measures have to be offered to both the complainant and the respondent throughout the process. And one thing that the regulations or the final rule and commentary make clear is that we're not talking about equal supportive measures, because it wouldn't necessarily make any sense at all to offer the same supportive measures to both the complainant and the respondent, but they need to be equitable. And there's a lot of talk about the difference between equality and equitability in the final rule and also in the paper that's provided in your materials. But equitable supportive measures must be offered to both sides. A big one in the commentary that got a lot of attention from commenters is the presumption of non-responsibility on behalf of the respondent. The respondent must be presumed non-responsible, and the burden of proof in the situation is on the school district to prove culpability. And school districts were forced to choose between adopting a preponderance of the evidence standard or a clear convincing evidence standard in that burden of proof. So again, we were tasked with saying, okay, do you want to review under preponderance of the evidence or clear and convincing? And what does that mean? Okay, well, let's talk about slightly more than 50% or 75% or so sure that the complaint of action occurred. So just not a natural way of thinking in the administrative world. So moving on a little bit here, the investigation process is the first place you really read about in the final rule about where bias can slip in and really mess things up. And the way the regulations prevent that, in a sense, is by having the burden of proof being on the school district and the presumption of non-responsibility, and the evidence gathering burden is on the investigator, on the school district. It's neither party's responsibility to gather the evidence and present it. The school district must do it. Neither party can be prevented from discussing the allegations or gathering or presenting evidence. I think that's really, really unique, because any of us in here who have either represented the client to write a memorandum about an investigation or represent clients receiving such a memorandum have probably seen some level of a gag order that says you are directed not to speak about this matter with anybody other than your representative and me, the investigator or decision maker. Well, the Title IX regulations say that we're not allowed to take that stance, that we have to allow a party to go out and, you know, gather their own evidence, to talk to potential witnesses and discuss their case. We can't limit that. Each side has to have the equal opportunity to present their evidence and are allowed to have an advisor. And the parties have to be notified of each and every step of the way if there's going to be any hearing, interview, meeting, et cetera. The hearing requirements, thank goodness, on the K-12 side, we are not required to hold oral hearings. And I think that that's, and you can read it in the commentary too, that that's because of the undue pressure that could have on younger students being in a situation that's adversarial and live, So school districts are allowed to have a hearing by written questions instead to prevent that. Colleges are required to have the oral hearing. And regardless of the hearing, the investigative report has to be provided to both parties with all the evidence used in compiling that investigative report with 10 days to allow that party 10 days to respond to any such thing before it gets moved on to the decision maker. There's a rape shield protection that got adopted in these regulations, meaning the evidence of a complainant's sexual history is irrelevant unless you're using that to prove either that somebody other than the respondent committed the alleged act or to show consent. Other than that, the history of the complainant's sexual past is irrelevant.